This is Case Johnson. This is the Literally Podcast. Today we're podcasting from our home in honor of Booked on 25th on Historic 25th Street. Our guest today is Deborah Reed. Deborah Reed is the author of four novels, The Days When Birds Come Back, that comes out this January 9th, that will be released that day, Olivet, Things We Set on Fire, and Carry Yourself Back to Me. She has also authored two popular thrillers under the pen name Audrey Braun. Deborah holds a Master in Fine Arts and Creative Writing and is co-director of the Black Forest Writing Seminars at the University of Freiburg in Germany. She teaches creative writing at workshops around the U.S. and in Europe. She lives on the coast of Oregon. And just a note, she got her MFA at this school called Pacific University. I like it. It's a good one. I've heard good things. I've heard really good things about the teachers and about fellow students.
Don't you work there?
Do I? I should work there. You know, the amount of the props that I give them. That's the professional introduction that I'd like to give to Deborah. But on a side note, on a personal note, Deborah and I went to school together for 2 years, and we weren't extremely close while we were at the program, but I knew Deborah, and she was always extremely, extremely kind. But it wasn't until after we graduated that I found out that how kind she actually was. I had reached out to you probably a year after we graduated and asked a really simple question about a way to move forward within the writing career that I hadn't thought of before. And, you know, we probably had 10, 12 conversations within 2 years. But Deborah reached back to me, and it wasn't that she just gave me an answer, but it was this remarkable 2 to 3 page response that was not only helpful, that was not only giving, but it was a personal and kind beyond what you would expect from another writer. And that's my personal introduction to Deborah Reed, that she's not only a wonderful writer, and you'll see that within her prose, the kind of lyrical voice that she carries, but this is I think that loveliness and that giving soul that comes across within her writing is her as a person as well. So if you haven't read her, this is something that I really think that you need to get out and do immediately. From that, we're going to ask Deborah to read her first page from The Days When Birds Came Back.
It was nearly noon on the Oregon coast, the day already hot, when June Byrne shook out her father's old camp blanket on the backyard lawn, removed her t-shirt, and lay with bare breasts to the sun. She had phoned the contractor again, and, like last week and the week before, hung up at the sound of his voice. Except today, a woman answered and pleaded gently with June. "Why do you keep calling? What is it you want?" June was drawn to the warmth of her tone and hesitated before disconnecting the call. Aside from the golf course beyond the edge of the property, June's yard was relatively private, bordered by birch trees and evergreens and ferns. She lay squeezing her eyes shut, trying to exchange the world inside herself for the one out around her, the foul sea breeze slicing the air, the chickadees singing at the feeders. Every now and then, she heard the thwack of a short iron hitting a glassy little ball. But the salty sweat on June's upper lip made her think of margaritas on the beach, and June was 1 month sober, and yes, it was not quite noon. 35 years old, nearly 36, and at night with the windows open, June could smell her own skin, and she smelled different without the drinking. She was different, or perhaps she was something of a snake, having shed one skin to live inside another.
I'd asked Deborah to read up until that point because when teaching, I've taught a lot of classes about first pages and how first pages can set the tone for an entire book. And if written well, they can they can bring together everything that the book aims to do. And I think this first page of Deborah's does that wonderfully, in the sense that this last line of shedding skin from one skin to another leads to the actual premise and kind of inciting moment of the entire book. Can you, without giving away how this whole thing goes, elaborate on how your protagonist June is really not only shedding that skin metaphorically, but physically as well, or shedding a place to move to another place.
Sure. Well, let me say first, thank you, Case, so much for inviting me and for that very, very generous introduction that you gave me. Thank you so much. June was a very difficult character for me to write. I had to keep coming back to her again and again to try to understand her, the shell that she put out around her. She was kind of a hard person. And I did not understand fully what her background was until I got to know her by writing her. I knew that she had a drinking problem. I knew that she had stalled in her writing career, but I didn't know why. I mean, a divorce wasn't enough to have the effect that her past had on her, this hold that it had on her. So as her inner life began to unfold, which is the renovation and the giving away of her grandparents' house next door is the catalyst for the breaking open of who she, the renovation of June, if you will. Mm-hmm. That was when I began to understand and see just what she was up against and what had happened to her in her younger years when she lived in near her grandparents and with her grandparents in the bungalow and the carriage house next door. So it took me a while. I didn't know when I set out to write the book how heavy the pain was of her past. I knew more about Jameson, the other main character's tragedy, but I didn't understand her till I got there.
That's really interesting because it leads really to my next question about structure of this book. Because Jameson's character comes second. Well, he comes within the second chapter, not necessarily secondary when it comes to the dual narrative. But we get this beautiful scene with June laying out there and then calling. Well, should I tell people this? Calling mm-hmm. Jameson's home, and then it blends really naturally. And from a writer perspective, when it comes to craft, I think the best word that I could say is it's really cool. You know, I mean, the way that we get that first intro of the phone call to Jameson's home, and then the next chapter, we're getting this idea from the other side of what this phone call means. And it's I loved that connection between the chapters that almost, you know, was almost between the phone lines. It was like this kind of static in the air that works really well. But my question was that structurally you go back and forth between Jameson and June throughout. And I had, in my mind, I had thought because of how well written June was that she was probably your first, you came up with her first and knew her first, before knowing Jameson. And Jameson's written wonderfully as well, but the choice to go with her as the first chapter led me to think, oh, she probably started with the June in this development of this book. But when you wrote the first word, now it changes my question. When you wrote the first word, was the first word about Jameson or was it originally about June?
It was actually Jameson. Mm-hmm. I thought originally it was going to be his story. And I knew he was a guy who came and, you know, renovated houses. And it was going to be his story about how he came and he met this woman and she was going to be secondary. That the real story was going to be what happened to him and to his children. But June just took over. I ended up spending far more time with June and trying to understand her. And it was, after all, her property. And it just became mainly her story. And as I wrote each chapter, the alternating point of views between the two of them, I discovered the connections between them, all of these things that these threads that you find throughout, many of them, I should say, were not there at the start. They developed mostly by putting them in the same time and space. I began to see ways in which they were connected. And in fact, that phone call that you see on the other side of when you're at Jameson's house and there's someone calling and hanging up and they think it's somebody else. Mm-hmm. That came much later. That came when I was just about finished with the book. I went back in and I wrote that in because I wanted that the connection between the two of them to exist in the very first chapter in some form or another. Mm-hmm. And that's how I could do it without making them very apparently connected.
Right. That's really cool in the sense that for writers who are just getting started, I think that they look at a book like yours or many of your books and they say, you know, Deborah, she probably just had this all down. You know, she had it all laid out and everything was perfect. And, you know, it probably started with the phone call and the way, you know, and of course, if it's done well, it reads like that. You know, it read like that to me, of course, when I read it, like, oh, well, this phone call is kind of part of the whole thing.
And, oh, good.
You know, I'm and it leads us. That. Yeah, it leads us into that kind of foreshadowing of what's coming later. And it gives us that the audience a clue into, oh, what's happening where the dual protagonists don't know. And
I think sometimes you notice after the fact where the gaps are. And that was one of those moments for me where I had, you know, these whatever 300 pages laid out. And then you can see when it's a whole piece, what's lacking and where you might need to retrace your steps, add something in to fill in a gap here and there. And that just, the mentioning of that just happens to be one of those places. I mean, it was really at the very end, like the very final edits is when that actually went in with the hanging up the phone call thread throughout the book.
No, that's really, really interesting. I mean, we know this, these things happen as they go, but like I said, a lot of writers don't. And I think you explaining that, and a lot of our audience, you know, are budding writers, people who want to, they don't know anything about publishing. They don't know anything about long form writing. And it's so cool to, through you saying that, to let them know, you know what, this stuff, a lot of it comes a lot later. And it doesn't come so easy to an author like you, where when you read it, it feels like it does, you know?
Yeah, and that's what you hope at the end. You got to make it look like it's easy.
No. And it reads that way. It read that way to me. And Deborah sent me the book, I think, 3 days ago. And I started, I started that night. And I started that night thinking, you know, I'm going to get through this. And man, I was reading fast. I really loved it. I mean, yeah, well, first off, the prose is beautiful. But secondly, I was intrigued, crazily enough, because of that phone call all the way through. I mean, that was the part right at the beginning that made me think, you know what? There's going to be quite a few things woven through this that'll be foreshadowing towards the end. And I knew it. I didn't know the end, but I knew that it was going to happen. And I thought, I'm going to finish this. So I finished it late last night.
And so, as
I was telling Brandon, you know, since New Year's Eve, my wife and I, we've been going to bed early and stuff. So we've been doing a lot more reading and stuff. And so it worked out really, really well that way.
Oh, good.
The funny part about what you say about June is I'm going to read this verbatim.
Okay.
My next question was there any character in this book while writing it that has become vital that you didn't intend to do so? If not in this book, in any of your other books, how did that happen? And I think we already covered that with June, which is really, really cool for this book.
I think it's important to note that writers need to always leave room for discovery. So much will unfold if you are open to it and you are not steadfast with an outline. You allow your imagination to roam freely and you don't push back on things that bubble up that you feel an energy for. Go ahead and put them down and give them a try, because that's part of the wonder of storytelling. And that discovery for me is some of the very best parts of being a writer, is when I'm surprised by what the characters do, or I'm surprised by who shows up on the scene, and I get excited about it, and I get to watch it unfold, just like the reader.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, like I said, for young readers, it's so, I think it takes the pressure off them. You know, I think they think that everything is laid out, and that like they think Deborah Reed has all the answers before she gets even gets started.
Not even close.
Yeah, I was listening to your recent interview with what was the name of the
K-Boo. Between the Covers.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Between the Covers. Great interview. There was one part though that stuck out to me is where you talked about how before you write every day, you basically go through everything you've written before you yeah. get started. How does that work? I mean, I know, that's
the days get longer.
By the end, the first couple days, you know, it's a breeze. You know, you have read a little bit and then start writing, and by the end, you're probably reading a lot more than you are writing. Right.
That's exactly right. But I write fairly slowly, actually. I mean, it's funny to be called a prolific writer. You know, I hear that term because I have several novels that have come out in a short amount of time, but I still feel that I write very slowly and carefully, and I'm editing, you know, as I'm going along, so that when I go back the next day and I start at the beginning to read toward the place where I left off, or I have to begin writing that day, it goes fairly quickly mm-hmm. for me, because I'm not finding a lot of problems. And in that way, it's not quite as, dramatic or drawn out as it sounds. I mean, by the end, I am reading about 5 hours or something, you know, mm-hmm. in a day, and then comes the ending. But then it feels very natural to me. Like mm-hmm. I'm reading the book in its entirety, and then I'm getting to the place where the ending is about to be written, and I can really feel the direction at that point of where it's headed. When I don't do that, I get lost. Mm-hmm. I just simply feel lost, and it feels too patchwork and too scattered for me to know where it's going. Yeah,
and you said that, you know, it really puts you back in that world every single day. And that's,
yeah.
I mean, that's where you want to be, right? I mean, every single day is be in that world. There was another thing you said too about what you just mentioned again, is that there isn't a large revision process for you once you're done with the book because of the writing process and the way you do it, reading the book. And then, and I think you said something to the fact that it's hard for me to leave a line without making it feel right to move on to the next line.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a musical thing. It's the only way I know how to explain it. I grew up around a lot of musicians, and music was a big part of my life. And I tend to hear, and I do read it out loud also, my own work, but I tend to hear it as I'm writing it and read it, writing it and reading it out loud. And I get bothered by, I get annoyed if it doesn't sound right, or if it doesn't have that cadence that to me is the delivery for story in my mind, and the way that the narrative in my own brain and sort of, I don't know, spirit works. My family's all from the South, and they're great oral storytellers. Mm-hmm. They all have Southern accents, and they can really tell a story. And it's da 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 da. And there's always like this beat to it, and this bang at the end. And there's something to that on the page for me. I feel like it's ingrained in me. It's very innate. And so when I have lines, a paragraph or whatever that don't sound right, I just feel a sense of agitation or annoyance, and I really can't go on until I get that straightened out. And the funny thing about that is it's not just the sound of it, or even sort of, for lack of a better term, the beauty of the prose. It's also other things happen, you know, when you get a sentence right or a paragraph right. You discover things about the character or the plot. When you hit the right note or you find the right metaphor, it kind of triggers other things about the character mm-hmm. and the storyline. And so there's a lot of discovery that comes with getting the sentence right. It's not just the rhythm and the lyrical quality of it mm-hmm. for me.
Oh, absolutely. And I love how you say that you are discovering even within the way in which something's written about your character. And while you write it about your character, which I think is a perfect segue into the reading at the end of chapter three, looking at those couple paragraphs, because I think you just nailed it into making these really, really specific decisions about how a sentence is written and how a paragraph is written. This is Case Johnston. It's the Literally Podcast. We are speaking today with Deborah Reed. She's the author of The Days When Birds Come Back that will be launched January 9th. She'll have a reading at Powell's Bookstore that evening, I believe. And later on this month at King's English. Have you gotten a date for that yet?
I don't have a date yet for it. It'll be Elliott Bay in Seattle before that.
Elliott Bay in Seattle, which is a great bookstore. Oh my gosh, one of my favorite bookstores in the world. All
and
three
Skylight
of them.
Skylight Books in Los Angeles also next month. So I'm making my way over to Salt Lake.
Well, when you do, let us know and we will definitely put it out there. We'll rebroadcast the podcast and then we'll make sure everybody knows that you'll be at King's English, which is such a wonderful bookstore in Salt Lake City where we bring in really good writers. So we're lucky to have you. All right, go for it.
She'd risen very slowly, placed her feet gently on the floor. Her legs shook, all of her shook. Her tongue was glued to the roof of her mouth, and she was soaked through with sweat. She had wet herself. She had shat herself. The stench alone was enough to make her sick. She could not stop shaking. She lowered her body to the floor and crawled in the direction of the shower. Each movement seemed like that of a crippled cat, every step forced and calculated against the corresponding throb of agony. She finally made it to the liquor cabinet, where she sat on her knees and caught her breath. This was not the time to quit drinking, not like this. She couldn't do it this way, even if she wanted to, so she leaned her head against the wall and swallowed straight from the bottle, breathing harder through her nose as the liquid drenched her throat, her hand shaking so badly she repeatedly missed her mouth, and the bottle slipped and vodka poured down her legs and into the cuts on her knees. She snatched it up with a tempered rage, her mind slowly rousing as the drink set her system back to its fragile stasis. By the time the bottle was empty, she recalled with perfect clarity that the last thing she had said to Niall, that thing about hoping he'd live to regret what he had done, was the very last thing June's father had said to her.
I think your move into talking about sentences works really well with those two paragraphs. I mean, we get some truncation that moves this kind of person forward, and we're in there with her, you know. And I think, I mean, and you, I hope that you can do a lot better justice to this than I can. But with these sentences, if you can think back to when you wrote them. Mm-hmm. What was your goal within them? And maybe even like you said before, what was happening while you were writing? If you could think, I mean, I know it's probably been, a year and a half since you've written those words?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you chose that scene there because, you know, she's an alcoholic and she's really hit rock bottom at this point. And, you know, how many times have we read a scene where that is the case? Like, how do you write a scene of a person who is this sort of desperate drunk, who is grabbing for the bottle and completely lost in their lives, and they've lost all the people around them because of their addiction? I think it's important when you're writing a scene that does have like the grotesque elements of she shat herself, she wet herself, she'd vomited, all of these things that you, for me as a writer, and what I also like to read is that I think the prose should be fairly lovely during those moments. And I think that it's a way of relaying the awfulness that we've all seen a million times on the page. But if you add in your own artful way of saying it, then you kind of cement it into the reader's mind as a different sort of meaning that is particular to this character, to this story. It's a way of setting it apart. So if you use language that is in a more lyrical or beautiful prose style when you're describing something awful, I think it's very effective. Cormac McCarthy does that. You know, you think about a book like The Road. I mean, it's just tragic from start to finish. It's just all these horrible things. It's a very dark novel, and yet it's so beautifully written that we just want to read it again and again, sentence by sentence. And that's what went into writing that piece. I knew that I had to write her in a very desperate way, but I didn't want it to be cliche. And one of the ways to stay away from cliche when you have to write a scene that we've seen so many times is to use language to elevate it out into something else.
Right. Well, it's a, you know, it's a beautiful scene. And the writing, the prose is lovely. And that's why it stuck with me overnight, over the last two nights after I read it. I thought, you know, this is something I want to talk about. And I think you nailed it in the sense that as writers, we can look at a scene that is somebody's on they're broken down, and we say that's beautiful. You know, I mean,
right.
You know, you look at it, you think, well, you know, but at the same time, you've spent, I mean, how long did you spend with June while writing this book? And so you know her so well that there's a distancing, isn't there, from what's happening to her on the page and the way in which you want to write her.
Yeah. And in fact, when you have a character like June who's very problematic, and I've had some people say, you know, I don't know if I liked her, or I didn't like her in the beginning, and that kind of thing. Not to get into the whether or not characters have to be likable. In my opinion, they just have to be interesting. Mm-hmm. But women characters tend to, you know, there's a whole thing about, well, they need to be likable, which, you know, no need to go there. But what, my point is that making that scene for her, I needed her to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And that is a scene that, for all of her crankiness or for a reader's inability to connect to her, I needed to have scenes like this one to redeem her in a way, to show the reader that she's very broken and she's very vulnerable, and you know, cut her some slack for now, and you'll find out soon enough how she got to be this way.
You know? Absolutely, and that is a whole discussion about how women, or not how, or how people believe that female protagonists need to be likable.
Likable. You know?
Well, it's the same larger discussion. As women in the workplace need to smile all the time,
yes, you know, and, exactly.
And we, I mean, I think as authors, this is one of the first things that we need to tackle with our books and with when we talk, you know, when we talk about these female protagonists that, you know what?
Yeah.
You know, a man can do anything, you know, and
that's
you'll
right.
still follow.
If there was a man that had all the same characteristics of being an alcoholic, and, you know, I think people would read him in general as just, you know, a troubled, interesting guy with a, you know.
Absolutely. You talk about Cormac McCarthy, and I'm currently rereading No Country for Old Men, and that is a book full of flawed men. You know, from on all over the spectrum, even the protagonist is extremely flawed.
Yeah,
and, but people, like you said, they're happy with it.
Yeah,
they're like,
yeah,
nobody's
they
saying
have to be likable.
No.
But they're awfully interesting. Mm-hmm. You know?
No one's saying that the sheriff needs to smile a little bit more.
But
you know, you know, I'm glad that you brought that point up, because I hope that we have a lot of women writers who can learn from that and say, you know what, if somebody tells me my female character needs to be more likable, they can go tell it to somebody else.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah. And I love it. I love that. And, we've talked a lot about June, but as noted, like, Jameson is this other big character, and he's at a point where he has lost too, a lot of loss. And that's where they converge within this book. Without giving a lot away, give as much, you're the author, you can give as much away as you want to.
Okay.
But without giving too much away, where does Jameson fall into this idea of these, well, where does he, first off, where does he fall into June's life? But secondly, where does he fall into place when it comes to these structures out in Oregon?
Well, as far as June goes, you know, they're both, the two of them are examples of living in the past, and the novel sort of moves from the past toward the present when they finally meet in person. And so they are bound together with their inability to let go of the past and the ways that it is weighing on each of them. Their circumstances are different, but in some ways they're very similar. Jameson lost his children, and when they were 7 years old, twins. When June was 7 years old, she lost her father. There are these themes that run, that connect them in varying ways. Jameson used to live where June was raised, and he was raising his own children there. So there's a lot of things that dovetail the two of them together to make a bigger whole, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I forgot what the second question was. Just,
I did too.
Something about, I think, place.
Yeah. What does place to these two characters mean within the book? This, because there's a renovation that needs to happen before something, yeah, before the grandparents' home is sold. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to him as a dual protagonist?
Well, he has left this place, I should say, and he's gone to live in the high desert in eastern Oregon. He's fled because he lost his children on the coast of Oregon, and he and his wife have moved and are now living in eastern Oregon, where it's very dry and craggy and a very different, which I think is a great metaphor for, you know, their hearts. Mm-hmm. And so he has to, he's kind of forced financially to take this job that he's been offered by June and return to the very place where this tragic incident happened. And, you know, I live on the Oregon coast, and it is such a paradox. I mean, it's stunningly beautiful and breathtaking, and it's also treacherous and dangerous and unforgiving. I mean, the storms here are legendary. I live in a tsunami zone. I live on top of the Cascadia subduction zone. Mm-hmm. So there are two fault lines running next to each other. So setting the novel and those two characters down in that place where I am myself had, it just really resonated with the story as a whole, because there is, you have all of this stunning beauty and the natural world, which is calm and soothing and puts one at peace. But at any moment, tragedy can strike, and it did for both of them. Mm-hmm. And so then they're in this house, or they're dealing with this house set in this place, and the house is worn down and beaten up by the weather, the moisture, the mold, rodents, you name it. But it was once this beautiful place of beautiful memories. And so there's just this juxtaposition ongoing throughout both characters and throughout the setting of extremes at one end and the other.
Yeah. I love the contrast that you've set up within the book. I mean, it works really well.
Thank you.
Contrast,
I'm glad to hear that.
The contrast, the buildup of things that were once lost, all of these thematic elements running through the new book were just beautiful. And
thank you.
As soon as it comes out, you know, I'm gonna buy 10 copies and give them away. You know? I mean,
thank you so
really
much.
That good. So before we end, I have two more questions. The first is there anything that you want readers to know about this book before signing off?
Oh gosh. The book, it's a sad story. It's sad. The characters are grieving, and there's a lot of loss, but I think there's also, even throughout, before you come to the ending, I think throughout the book there is redemption in the beauty of the surroundings and in the character's ability to recognize that beauty. Like in the way that Jameson fashions a bird bath out of a busted copper gutter, and he just wants to watch this beautiful warbler in the bird bath. That the story as a whole is meant to be a contemplation and a bit slow. I know you read it fast, which is great. But I guess to me, it feels like a slower story and a slower build up toward healing. And for all of its sadness, I hope that the reader gains empathy for these people and for people in their own lives, and a sense of hope.
I think they will, I really think they will. And if anybody is looking for the book, they can find it obviously through Amazon and online. They can order through their local bookstore, which I would suggest. It's always good to keep our local bookstores in business. If you're here in Ogden, please order through Booked on 25th on Historic 25th Street. If you're in Salt Lake, there's a lot of great bookstores to order through, but King's English is a great one. And Deborah will be joining us in Salt Lake soon enough, and she's going to let us know when that date is. Thanks so much for joining us. It's
Well, thank you.
been great to talk to you. And like I said at the beginning of the podcast, the loveliness in the prose equates only the kindness in the person with Deborah. I can't tell you enough about her. And hopefully we'll become even better friends along the way. Thank you again so much, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Thanks again.